So Rashi, last time we spoke, you said you had thrown your hat in the ring for the presidency. How's the?
Well, I threw your hat in the ring because I didn't want anybody stepping on my hats.
How are the primaries going for you?
I like the primates. It's the only kind I like. We're all monkeys.
Okay, so I guess you've gotten the marmoset vote and the spider monkey and the gorilla.
Yeah.
What's your platform?
My platform is about 6 feet high so I can reach the bananas in the banana trees.
You know, there have been worse candidates.
I'm better than Santorum, you gotta admit that. And at least I'm not promising you the moon like Gingrich. These guys are ridiculous.
You're right. Man, he's got my vote. I think we should start going door to door.
Yeah, maybe they'll give us some money.
Hi, this is Paul Dini, and
you didn't sound like you knew who you were for a minute there.
I tend to forget.
This is a very unsure podcast.
Hi, this is Paul Dini. Steve Dini.
Misty Lee. What? I thought you had forgotten who you were.
Oh, no, I was making fun of you.
Oh, okay.
And then I screwed up my own intro. Well, we have Mark Evanier here.
Who? Oh. Who is not running for president.
Nobody should be. I would vote for Mark.
Right now there are Republicans who would vote for Rashi over some of their options.
I know,
point.
They're pretty bad.
Yes.
Well, we should run him for president. I mean, let's...
You know, when I was in 19... whatever, when I was in college, I voted for Daffy Duck as a write-in. I'd had it. I thought Kerry was too beige, and I wasn't going the other way. So I wrote in Daffy Duck.
I think I did, too. Several years before that. Mm-hmm. I know one year I did vote for the Lone Ranger. I was so disgusted with it with all the other choices. This year, I think Screwy Squirrel has a good shot. Mm-hmm. With Newt Gingrich promising candidates the moon, saying the moon will be the 52nd
straight. But only in his second term. That's the nice part.
Oh, yes.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, his second term, yes. By the end of my second term.
Because the trillions it'll take to get up there will totally help us.
Yes, because we have plenty of money around to spend in
this country.
Absolutely.
And NASA's up and running so well right now.
Yeah. So, Ricardo Montalban.
Well, yeah.
Well, that's random.
No, it's not. It's not random at all. If
we're doing our second week of talking to Mark Evanier.
She's been thinking about her privileges all week.
I've been thinking about luchador masks, but I'm not allowed to bring them up anymore. I'm going to get kicked out of my seat.
Or wear them.
Well, and I was actually sitting here going, I have that silver one with a big M on it. And I was going to like run out of the room and put it on and come back in. I don't know where it is. And so I was really upset about that. And so now you can cheer me up with Ricardo Montalban.
Ricardo Montalban's story. All right.
Yes.
fine.
As you may remember, last week we were talking about Hervé Villechaize, who was
not in a luchador suit.
Yes.
Yes. Hervé Villechaize, I'm sorry, Mark. I'll stop.
This is another theme show, I can tell.
Oh,
all right.
It's always a theme with me.
So, Hervé left Fantasy Island.
He was tattooed on Fantasy Island.
He was tattooed. He was the little assistant to Mr. Rourke, mm-hmm. played by Ricardo Montalban.
God, if we could all
and Hervé left. The story is that at one point, Hervé had these grandiose thoughts that he was, you know, Jack Lemmon and he should be starring in those nice. Kind of movies.
Because he wasn't, because he shouldn't have been.
And Ricardo, who was very fed up with him, took him aside and he says, you know, Hervé, I think this role is holding you back. I think you should go off to something else. So they got rid of Hervé.
Uh-huh.
And they replaced him with a new character who was going to be kind of like an English butler.
Okay.
And they hired a man, people may remember, named Christopher Hewitt.
Okay.
Okay.
To be to be the new sidekick to Mr. Rourke for the last season. So I was doing a show for ABC, one of those shows that no one remembers. It was a stealth series. It was on off the air in 5 weeks.
Okay.
Like Tower
it was
Prep.
Called it was called the Half Hour Comedy Hour.
I remember
it was,
that
it was
show.
It was basically Rowan and Martin's Laugh In rolled into one.
Yeah.
It was a shameless ripoff by some of the same producers.
Uh-huh.
And we had a fine troupe of people. Arsenio Hall was on the show. Jan Hooks and Victoria Jackson were on that show before they were on Saturday Night Live.
Before Victoria Jackson went crazy.
Yes, this is back when Victoria was sane.
And before she ate Victoria Jackson.
Or sane her, yes.
Turn said.
And we had a lot of fun people on the show. And we had lots of cameo guests. So ABC said, you got to put Ricardo Montalban on as a cameo guest. He's going to come over and do a cameo with Christopher Hewitt, who was not yet on the air as the sidekick.
That's kind of a nice exposure for you guys to be
announcing
this.
So we had to write a bit
that
would work for not only be a joke for Ricardo Montalban to do, but something that would get the exposition, explain who Christopher Hewitt was.
And was going to be.
So we wrote this routine, and the way we did that show, when we had guest stars, which is we had a nice large writing staff, and they would grab whatever writers were around when the guest star arrived, and we'd go into the room and we would act the bit out for them. We would portray it for them and then adjust the copy if necessary, you know, the joke, go over it with them.
Not nerve-wracking at all.
So we were saying that, and Christopher Hewitt walks in. And I said, because I couldn't resist this, I said, "Max, he's not wearing a dress."
Oh,
Christopher Hewitt played the character in The Producers.
Uh-huh.
Right? Oh, that's right. That's
And he laughed at that. We talked for a bit about The Producers. And I had seen Christopher Hewitt in Peter Pan playing opposite Sandy Duncan. He was Captain Hook.
And Mr. Sandy, Darling.
When Sandy Duncan toured as Peter Pan.
I bet he was brilliant. Production.
He was wonderful. So. Yeah. I complimented him on it, and because every so often it's important in my life to say something really, really stupid, I said to Christopher Hewitt, "Have you been on Broadway?"
Oh, no.
And, you know, because you were so wonderful. He says, "Yes, I was in a little play once that came to Broadway. It was called My Fair Lady."
He was
in the original My Fair Lady.
Have you heard of this?
And I go, "Oh yeah, that."
Oh, that thing. That just kind of blipped by.
Yes, and he was in about 19 others.
Of course.
So, and the minute I said it, I knew I was said something in me. Anyway.
Yeah.
So we wrote
those
this
moments where you could just feel the hole in the boat carving itself.
So we met Mr. Montalban, who was charming, of course, and we met Christopher. So we act out the bit for him. Now, the routine we had written was, I'm going to tell you the routine, and it involved a young lady who was blonde and very gorgeous and not quite fitting into her dress fully.
Awesome.
All right.
I like it already.
So we're at a party, and Christopher Hewitt is sitting opposite Ricardo Montalban.
Uh-huh.
And this is going to sound awkward, but we had to somehow explain who Christopher Hewitt was in this context. So Ricardo Montalban says to Christopher Hewitt, "Christopher Hewitt, now that you are coming on to Fantasy Island to play my sidekick," subtle, huh? "you're going to have to learn the problems we have on the show." And Christopher Hewitt says in the script we wrote, "Yes, I know, I've seen the cleaning bill for those white suits." And Ricardo Montalban says, "No, no, the problem is that people think that I'm actually the character of Mr. Rourke, that I can actually grant their fantasies." And Christopher Hewitt says, "I find that hard to believe. People can't tell that you're just an actor playing the part." He says, "No, no, they think that I can grant their fantasies." Isn't that ridiculous? And just then, the beautiful blonde woman with the big cleavage runs up and goes, "Oh, Mr. Rourke, you've got to grant me my fantasy. Please, Mr. Rourke, I have this fantasy. I've had it for all my life. You've got to grant it for me." And Christopher Hewitt starts to say, Ricardo Montalban has to say, "Excuse me, young lady, you don't understand." And she goes on, she says, "My fantasy has been to be marooned on a desert island with Ricardo Montalban." And Christopher Hewitt starts to say, "Now, see here, young lady, he's not a..." And then Ricardo Montalban says, "Hold on, maybe just this once."
Yeah, totally.
All right? So now we act this out for Mr. Montalban and Mr. Hewitt, and they laugh, and Ricardo Montalban so charmingly says, "Oh, that is so clever. You are witty, and I don't know how to tell you this. I feel bad about telling you this, but here's my problem. And I would do your routine in a second. But I have been married to the same woman for 47 years. My wife was very well an actress, and I am considered kind of a role model in the Latino community. And I have been trying to counteract the idea of the Latin lover, the man who is not faithful to his wife. And the one thing I wouldn't want anyone to say was that I ever cheated on my wife. Is there some way you could do something else? Like could you have her say, 'My fantasy is to cook a meal for Ricardo Montalban'?" And we went, "Nah, give us a second." And he was so nice about it. You know, sometimes when actors ask for line change, what you want to say is, "Hey, just read the copy we wrote for you, you know, you cannon fodder." But he was so charming. "Wait, give us a second." Then the other writers and I huddled. We came back and we said, "How about if she says, 'My fantasy is to write, produce, and direct a film on the epic life of Ricardo Montalban. And he goes, ah, fine, that is wonderful. That is very clever. That is very nice of you. That is wonderful, yes. And then he looks at me, and this is Ricardo Montalban. You have to imagine him saying this. He looks at me and he says, I would never want people to think that I would cheat on my wife. I don't mind if they think I'm a conceited asshole, but I don't want them to think I cheat on my wife. And I laughed for about 8 minutes.
Yeah.
I thought he was so, so wonderful.
Oh, he sounds cool.
Yes.
I worked with him a few times on Freakazoid. He was
yeah.
A, he played a recurring villain named Gutierrez, who was
the main bad guy.
The main bad guy. And he was just wonderful because he would come in and he'd read the script. And I don't think he completely understood what he was doing, but he gave it such style. And he was so funny. And even if he didn't get it, just the fact that he went at it with such gusto made the character wonderful. He was just... he was terrific.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah.
He'd be a great luchador.
You've worked on a lot of variety shows and a lot of comedy shows, Mark.
Yes.
Do you like working in a room? Do you like working in the room with a bunch of other writers?
Up to a point, there's something wonderful about it, but I would never want to make it all my writing.
Right.
You know, you get torn between writing. There's something very fun about sitting home all by yourself and writing, if you become a writer. And there's something very fun about being in an office surrounded by people and working with the actors. So, you know, in the ideal world, you have a mix of that. You get to sit at home and write for a couple of weeks, and then you get to go into the studio and work with people for a couple of weeks, and then you get to go home and write on your own. I didn't like writing gang style all the time because you just... You lose sense of you lose sense of possession. You lose, you end up looking at the sketch and going, did I come up with that line or did I write that part? It's
right.
It's a little disconcerting.
When you work on a sitcom like I in your column recently on your site, you talked about the series Bob and you wrote a couple of episodes of Bob. Were those? Did you work in the room or
I worked out the stories with the producers and I went home and wrote it and brought it in and then they rewrote much of it. That's okay. No, that's fine. I just, there's something very compelling for some of us about sitting alone and writing on your own and you finish it and then after you're satisfied with it, then it goes into the process and people start rewriting or you rewrite or they give you notes.
Right, right. I just enjoy asking other writers, you know, what the process is because, you know.
It's fun in a limited basis. It's fun, actually, it's not a bad way to write short sketches.
Right.
And things like that. But you know, if all you're trying to do is just have people laugh at it, then that's not a bad thing. If you're trying to do a little more than just be funny, then it's difficult because then that kind of writing is kind of has to come out of one head.
Yeah, that's what I noticed on the shows I've worked on, like on the drama shows. It's been like, everybody's in the room throwing around ideas and it gets very chaotic and there comes a point where the showrunner just takes it and we don't see it anymore until they shoot it. He just hammers it into whatever he feels it has to be at that point. But again, you know, it's all different. You know, for me, I prefer to be at home myself.
Yes. All right.
Do you like working on dramas at all, Mark? Or is it just
I haven't done too many dramas. You get typed as a certain kind of writer. People always want to hire you to write the same thing you wrote last time. Mm-hmm. And I got typed for a while. I was typed as a sitcom writer. Then I was typed as a variety show writer. Then I was typed as an animation writer. And then when I was doing animation, I would do an adventure show. And then they didn't want to give me comedy shows. And I do a comedy show finally. And then they didn't want to give me adventure shows.
Oh, wow.
And
Is there any style that you'd like to try your hand at, like a mystery or a horror or anything like that?
I'd love to do a Western. I don't think there's any place in the world where anybody will pay you to do a Western these days.
That's unfortunate. Unless it's a space Western, I guess.
Yeah, something like that. I like writing mysteries. I like writing mystery stories. I've written a few things like that. My agent used to sell me as a wild card. If you don't know what kind of writer you want, hire Mark because he does all these different things. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily a good thing. I mean, sometimes that's the person who does lots of good things is not very good at any one of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, you try to write stuff that interests you, and I like writing things I haven't written before. Mm-hmm. I've turned down jobs where I thought I've written this show already. You know, there was a lot of period when I was offered a lot of Scooby-Doo ripoffs. And I thought, well, I've written Scooby-Doo. I don't necessarily want to write that show again.
Yeah. Yeah, I found, like, people tend to offer me a lot of superhero stuff. And if I just don't have any particular feel for the superhero, I've passed on them. Or action-adventure shows. It just doesn't appeal to me. There has to be something compelling about the lead character or the situation that makes me want to jump on board. But I have had that trouble with agents also. Like, I've had many agents, and they've all said, I don't know how to sell you. Mm-hmm. I mean, you wrote, you know, you'll write, you know, a drama show like Lost, and then you'll turn around and, you know, write, you know, Bugs Bunny or something. Or
Daffy Duck.
Duck Dodgers. Yeah. It's like, how do I sell you? It's mm-hmm. like, and then I'm put in the position of, well, I have to go out and get my own work, and then the agent takes his percentage, which is kind of nice for him.
My first agents, I had a partner at the time, Dennis Palumbo, and our agents wanted us, was selling us as sitcom writers, and he didn't want me writing anything but sitcoms. And I got an offer to write the Wonder Woman show, the Linda Carter one, and he didn't want me to take it. He said, no, it's diffusing your image as a sitcom writer.
Wow.
And he just said, we're selling you guys as sitcom writers now, and in the time, during the time you might write that Wonder Woman, I can get you a sitcom episode someplace, and that will, you know, there's a career planning there. And he wasn't wrong in terms of marketing, because that's the agent's job. The agent's job is to do the marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your job to sometimes say, I know this is not the financially prudent job for me, but it's something I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes we want to turn down the best paying job or the best career advancing job and do something we just love to do. That show I mentioned, the half-hour comedy hour, I just wanted to do that show because of the people involved with it and to write that format. And I turned down, I left That's Incredible to write that half-hour comedy hour.
Wow.
And That's Incredible paid a lot more money.
Very successful.
But I had written That's Incredible. I was getting bored with it. I did it for 3 years, and I had gotten bored with that show, and I wanted to get out of it.
Well, it's like you said, you had already written that show.
Yes.
I have a quick question for you about writing, and then I have some, of course, I have a million questions about your stories because I friggin' love them. Do you go through a process? Paul and I were talking last time we did a podcast, just him and I, about his percolation process and like the way that he processes a story. And one of the things that I've noticed him do, and I was going to ask you if you go through the same thing, is he outlines something and then he'll start it. You know, he'll get his notes and he'll start it, and then it's really difficult for him sometimes to piece those pieces together, and then he'll kind of go through what I call a percolation process, where the story kind of rises up and then it pop 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 and it goes to the top of his head, and then he finally gets it and boom, it's all laid down in a night. What is your process when you're kind of figuring things out? Is it methodical? Do you not want to talk about it? Is it different every time?
I don't like to discuss a story in progress.
Okay.
I don't write an outline unless it's required for the
like a milestone,
the protocol
for
of the show. Well, the producer needs an outline before he'll go okay this or whatever.
For approval.
What I generally do is I figure out what the story's about, and I figure out roughly where I'm going to go, and then I trap myself.
Okay.
And I frequently don't know what's on the next page. It's like an interesting challenge to do.
Well, because I know for you, a lot of times you write fast because you're very prolific.
Well, I write fast because they force me to, usually.
Okay.
I mean, you this is one of the interesting things, is once you get typed as a guy who can write it overnight, they only give it to you to do it overnight.
Yeah.
I one time, ABC wanted to call me, and they wanted me to write a pilot for them, and I said, can I have till next Friday? And they said, Mark, if we had till next Friday, we would have given it to you on Wednesday.
Oh, my God.
And they were serious about that, because, you know, that happens at times.
Mm-hmm.
There's an advantage to writing. There are a couple of advantages to writing fast, one being that sometimes they can't do anything but use it as it is. If it comes in that late, you know, if you hand the script in the day before they have to shoot it, you know, they can't suddenly send you back for a lot of rewrites. And also, it's very exhilarating to me to write something you know is going to get filmed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for me to write something that I don't think is going to ever get in front of a camera, even if I'm going to get paid for it. A couple of times in my life, I've had to write stuff that I knew was never going to get made, and it was very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, you'd think, well, that I can put down anything and it's not going to matter. But in fact, it's just very tough to get yourself to the process. The disadvantage of writing at the last minute is that you get finished and you go, hey, this isn't bad for 2 days' work. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way the audience looks at it. The audience doesn't care how long you took to. And you look at these things. I wrote a Yogi Bear Christmas special once in 2 days because that's all I had to do it in. They came to me literally and said, we need this, you know, day after tomorrow.
And this wasn't like a 15-minute. This was like
this was
hour.
A half-hour primetime thing. God. It was called Yogi Bear's All-Star Christmas Caper, I think. I forget what it's called, something like that.
Okay.
December 20th.
And I remember it had to air on Christmas. It was a Christmas special, and I did it in July. And I did it, not only did I have to write it, what had happened was that Hanna-Barbera had made a deal to do a primetime Yogi Bear Christmas special, and they couldn't get a script that the network would approve. And it actually supposed to have been for the previous year, and at some point it was too late, and the network said, we'll kick it over till next year. And then they wrote more scripts, and they must have spent $300,000-$400,000 writing scripts that were thrown away over and over. Everybody in the building had written a script by this, and then they finally went to the network and said, "Well, we're not going to have a script you guys like this year, so we'll kick it over to next year." And the network said, "No, if we don't get a script for this year, we're killing the project. We're not going to honor the commitment."
Oh wow!
So there was a guy at CBS at that moment who was a big fan of mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's moments when there's nobody like that. You know, every so often you have those moments.
But you had a lot of executives like that because you'd saved many over there.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
So this guy basically said, if you get Evanier to write this thing, we'll probably approve it sight unseen.
Wow.
And so I get called in to Joe Barbera's office, and they told me this situation. And they said, it has to be a half-hour Christmas special with Yogi and Boo Boo in it, and we want to put all the other characters in. We want Huckleberry Hound and Quick Draw McGraw and Snagglepuss and all these different characters, and we want to have Fred and Flintstone and Barney Rubble make a cameo, and you can do anything you want beyond that, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them an idea I had, which is an idea I tried to sell. Every time I did a Christmas special, or was asked to do a Christmas special, I tried to sell the same idea. And it's the one that you couldn't do in Christmas. They will never let you do in a Christmas special. I wanted to do Christmas without snow, Christmas in places where it doesn't snow.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I wanted to do the thing about, it's not Christmas, there's no snow. No, Christmas is not about snow.
Right. Exactly.
My whole life I've had Christmas without snow.
Mm-hmm.
And every single Christmas special I've ever seen, it's all about snow.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, let's do, for the first Christmas special that ever isn't about snow. And they go, no, you can't do that. You got to have snow.
Oh, my
God. So that was the one thing they turned down.
Wow.
And they said, as long as it's got snow, you can do anything you want. So I went home and I wrote this thing. And to add to the pressure, Dawes Butler, the voice of Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, Quick Draw, and 93 other characters in the show, was his first job when he came back from having had his stroke.
Oh,
it
no.
was the first, and Dawes is a man we love dearly. Mm-hmm. He was one of my closest loving people in my life.
I was just talking about him. He's one of my favorite actors of all time.
I think he was the greatest voice actor ever lived, and he was one of the nicest, most wonderful men who ever walked this planet.
Mm-hmm.
People who know Jack Kirby, you know, is like amazing you got to work with Jack Kirby. Yeah, it's just as amazing I got to work with Dawes Butler.
Oh, yeah.
They were both great in their own way. They were both mm-hmm. the top of the form in their own area. And they had some certain similarities. Also, both very short men. Anyway, so, and then to add to that, the animation union was about to go on strike.
Oh, my God.
Oh, boy.
And I had to have the script in by a certain... In order to get the script storyboard, there was going to be animated in Australia, but they had to have the storyboard finished by a certain date. So every more day that I took writing the script was a day less that the storyboard guys and the layout guys had to do their parts of it. And it was an impossible thing. It was one of those things where Bill Hanna said to me, there's no way to get this show on the air September 18th or December 18th when it was supposed to be on, but we're going to try it anyway. And they did it. It meant putting on a lot of animation errors and mistakes and things that could have been fixed, but they did make it. So I had 2 days to write the thing, and I went home and I wrote a script that I thought was fine for 2 days. I see it to this day, and I think to myself, gee, I wish they'd given me a month on this one. This was such to have all those, to have the voice cast we had on the thing. Obviously, we had to have Dawes Butler and Don Messick because we had Yogi Bear and Boo Boo. Mm-hmm. The minute they added Barney Rubble to it, we got Mel Blanc in the cast. Mm-hmm. The minute they added Fred Flintstone to it, we got Henry Corden in the cast. When they had, since I had put Doggy Daddy in it, that mm-hmm. meant we got John Stevenson in the cast. Mm-hmm. They needed a female. They had Janet Waldo in the cast. It was like the all-star cast. And then I had this character who was kind of a businessman. They cast Hal Smith.
Oh, come on.
For it. Mm-hmm. So I had the credits on the show read. And they, and I stuck Yaki Doodle, the little duck, in it.
Yeah.
So I had Jimmy Weldon come in, who was one of my favorite kids show hosts from the 16, the original voice of Yaki Doodle. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden I look at this cast, and I had McGill the Gorilla in it, so they got Alan Melvin in. Mm-hmm. So the whole cast was Dawes Butler, Don Messick, Mel Blanc, John Stevenson, Janet Waldo, Henry Corden, all these people I mentioned, Jimmy Weldon, Hal Smith, and on the one hand I was proud that I got the thing done. On the other hand, I thought to myself, gee, these guys deserve a script that was written. That went through a second draft. These guys deserve a script with a little more polish in it.
Or even you might have deserved, you might have enjoyed a chance to play with it. And say, well, if I'm going to have this, it might be fun to do that with her or with him or with, whatever.
And then the other thing was that the show was running so late, they had to drop a scene that I liked very much in it. My favorite scene got cut out because they didn't have time to animate it.
Oh.
They just could not get the show physically done.
Well, what was it? Can you
tell us? Well, what it was, the premise of the show was that Yogi was supposed to hibernate, and instead of hibernating, he was running around celebrating Christmas, and he caused all this trouble for the ranger because he was doing this.
He went to the city to see his friends, and they came to see him.
Yeah. Anyway. So the last scene was supposed to be,
this was the scene
that the network liked the best. So naturally, it didn't get made. Mm-hmm. Was the last scene was Yogi is back in his cave, and the ranger's saying to him, "Aren't you going to hibernate, Yogi? Please hibernate, Yogi. Please give me my months off. Mm-hmm. Hibernate." And Yogi says, "Well, I don't know if I can sleep." And the ranger says, "Please, Yogi, how can we help you to sleep?" And Yogi says, "Well, if you could read me a story, if you could sing to me." Mm-hmm. So the ranger goes, "I'm not going to sing to you." And then Yogi says, "Well, gee, then I might be up all winter." Mm-hmm. And then you hear the ranger suddenly going, "Silent night." And the ranger, off key, Don Messick did this wonderful job singing completely off key. And we rolled the credits over this.
Oh.
So the credits were to be done over the ranger singing off key. And every so often, he'd stop me getting sleepy, Yogi. No, silent.
Oh, that's fun.
And just go out to the end, and then over the Hanna-Barbera logo, you'd hear Yogi say the ranger at the end. "I'm going to sleep. Good night, Mr. Merry Christmas, Mr. Ranger, sir. Merry Christmas, Yogi." And they'd go out.
Nice.
And that was what the network loved. Everybody loved that scene, and they never got a chance to animate.
Oh boy,
that scene. So.
And half of it was under credit, so it's not like they needed to animate all of it.
But this was a notorious special for one reason.
Snagglepuss. Of course.
Snagglepuss became, I think, the first cartoon character in the history of television to ever be bleeped.
Yeah.
They bleeped one word that Snagglepuss said out of the show. What? Now, you say to yourself, what could I possibly have written? And they recorded it, mm-hmm. and they animated it. How could I have written how could a naughty word get through this process? Paul, tell them what the word was that they bleeped.
Hanukkah.
The word Hanukkah was bleeped from the show. I had a scene where
gave me shivers down my arm.
The characters rolled up in a bus, and Snagglepuss yelled out, "Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Hanukkah even."
Mm-hmm. Wait, and they bleep the happy Hanukkah.
They bleep the word Hanukkah.
Like he's actually saying like a bad word.
It's like a bad edit.
He goes happy even something.
Yeah, they bleeped Hanukkah. They cut it out. And the thing was interesting is nobody had a problem with it when it was in the script. Nobody had a problem recording it. It was animated. And then suddenly, when the show was all being assembled, somebody said, "We can't have Snagglepuss say Hanukkah." Now, you hear about the war on Christmas.
Yeah.
There's no war on Christmas. There was a war on Hanukkah that way.
Now, did they think it was being disrespectful to Hanukkah?
I could not get anybody to ever tell me why they did it.
Now you can't have a special without a mention of Hanukkah in it because they want to be all inclusive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it is on the negative.
Yeah, I think
they went back to the
time.
Negative,
so it's all,
which makes me think maybe it was done at Hanna-Barbera, not at the network.
Mm. Oh.
Somebody at Hanna-Barbera did the cut because it was not. It's on the negative. It's on the original DVD has it bleeped too.
Wow.
So you'd
have to go back to the original sound recording files to save that.
Yeah, I still have someplace a tape of Dawes' original voice tracks that has it on there. I should dig that out sometime and put it on the internet.
I'll remix it for you.
You know, so they cut it out.
They cut the mention of my holiday. How disrespectful. Anti-Semitic even.
Yes. Yeah, no kidding.
I shall complain.
So anyway. Wow. So that was...
They're jealous of the 8 days. They thought it was too much.
Yeah. That was the show. There was a guy at Hanna-Barbera in business affairs who had this idea to replace Dawes.
I love those decisions.
Yeah. What happened was that they had... You know, I'd written this show, and they did not have a deal with Dawes Butler to record the show. Dawes was playing Yogi and Huck, Snooper and Blabber, mm-hmm. Jinx, Hokey Wolf,
one of the Mises,
Augie Doggy. He had about 8 roles or 10 roles in the show.
Was he Pixie or Dixie?
He was Dixie.
Dixie.
Okay.
I don't think Pixie and Dixie had any lines in the show.
Okay.
He was playing Wally Gator. I think had a line in the show too. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
wow.
I put all these characters in just mm-hmm. you know. So this one executive at Hanna-Barbera, Dawes had an agent who was not a very good agent. He was an old timer, and he'd been, you know, there was a period when you didn't have to be a very good agent to be Dawes Butler's agent because everybody wanted to hire him. Mm-hmm. And this guy,
being Frank Welker's agent, it's like, well, just tell me where to send him.
Yeah. So they called me in one day. I was walking in the halls at Hanna-Barbera, and one of the assistant voice casting ladies comes up to me in tears. And she's upset. And I go, what's wrong? She says, they told us to start doing auditions to replace Dawes.
Oh, my God.
And I went, what? You know, remember I said told you a story about the one of the few times I threatened to hit somebody?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I came real close on this time. I went to this guy's office, and he said, Dawes is holding us up for too much money. His agent is holding us up for too much money. And, we have started arguing. And it was a very ugly argument. So in the peak of this, I'm on the hallway at Hanna-Barbera, and they were recording the Smurfs at Hanna-Barbera that day. And the session is just letting out. And first guy out of the session is Chuck McCann. And Chuck sees us in the hallway, bunch of us talking about this, and he goes, what's wrong? You can see that it's like a crisis. And we told him what was going on.
Chuck McCann was on the Smurfs.
He was on that episode.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He was in the session that day.
That's cool.
And he told we told Chuck, and Chuck turned purple. He was so angry.
Yeah.
And he turns to the next person who was coming out, who was Don Messick.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells them they're going to replace Dawes as Yogi. That. And then Don Messick says, well, they're going to have to replace Boo Boo too, because I'm not working with anybody but Dawes.
I love this.
And Chuck says, nobody auditions for this. None of us. The next person out of the session was Frank Welker. They said, they're going to have auditions to replace Dawes as Yogi and Huck and Quick Draw. And Frank goes, well, I won't be auditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next guy out was Paul Winchell. Uh-huh. And Paul Winchell, without even moving his lips, said, we're going to put up signs. We're going to paint signs. We're going to outside. We're going to go picket this studio. And all of a sudden, there's this insurrection. All because every voice guy in the business was in this Smurf session,
sure.
And they all were vowing, taking this blood oath, we're not going to replace Dawes. None of us will audition for this. So I stormed up to the business affairs guy's office, and I argued with him, and we yelled at each other for about 20 minutes. He was telling me, none of your damn business. You butt out of this. You know, you're done with this. You wrote your script. Get the hell out of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, you can't do this. A, you can't do this to Dawes Butler. He's the studio owes him too much. B, this is the first primetime Yogi Bear special ever. You're going to screw it up because they have the wrong voice. You're going to recast 8 roles in 3 days. We got to record this thing right now, you know. We're waiting. We're going to record this in 3 days. You can't do it. You cannot replace those voices. and you shouldn't replace those voices.
Well, and even if he did, whatever Dawes was asking for, you guys would have ended up paying multiple actors to do what he was doing.
That's right. So, and yes, okay. So anyway, so I barged into Joe Barbera's office. I walked down. I was so angry. It was about as angry as I've ever been in my life.
Uh-huh.
I barged into Joe Barbera's office, walked right past his secretary, stormed into his office, and I started yelling at Joe Barbera. So that I feel bad having done it because he had nothing to do with this.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, we try to do good stuff here, and there's always some idiot in the business affairs who screws us up. And I started, and finally, I had my checkbook with me. I pulled. Oh, I had found out from the business affairs guy that they were $1,000 apart.
Oh,
he didn't
God.
Tell me how much Dawes wanted, but they were $1,000 apart. So I pulled out, in Joe Barbera's office, I pulled out my checkbook, and I said, nobody wants to do these shows right, so here. And I wrote a check to Hanna-Barbera for $1,000, and I threw it on Joe Barbera's desk.
Good
and I said, here, why don't we just get Dawes to do this right? And Joe said to me, $1,000? It's $1,000? I said, yes, it's $1,000, or about what you spend on lunch. And he says, they told me that Dawes, they couldn't make a deal, and it was impossible. They didn't take me, it's $1,000. I said, $1,000. So Joe picks up the phone, and he calls the business affairs guy. And I remember this, Joe says, hi, I got Mark Avery near my office. And he had to pull the phone away from his ear, because from the other side of the phone, he started hearing the guy screaming, don't listen to him. And Joe Barbera said, give Dawes the $1,000. And the guy argues, and Joe says, my name's on the damn building. Give Dawes the $1,000. And he hangs up.
Mm-hmm.
And Dawes got his $1,000.
Nice.
And it wasn't me. It was Joe. I couldn't have done mm-hmm. anything about it.
Well,
And Dawes recorded the show 2 days later.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his first job back after his stroke. And he had had a problem. His voice had recovered, but he had a problem with his peripheral vision. He had lost his peripheral vision,
okay.
which he could only see like in a narrow tunnel. He couldn't see to the left or right of him. And the problem with that was that when we looked at the copy, he couldn't read ahead like he was used to. He couldn't read in the rhythm he had. And I had rehearsed him, and I went and I retyped the script in narrower columns for him.
Aww.
But he still had problems reading it. And he took 3 or 4 takes per line. Now, you know, Misty, that 3 or 4 takes per line is not uncommon.
Right.
Lots of actors, good actors, take 5 or 6 takes. Mel Blanc used to take 10 takes for every damn Bugs Bunny line he did.
Mm-hmm.
Dawes had this standard for himself. 3 takes was not up to, that was insulting, you know, mm-hmm. that he takes 3 takes for some line to get it right. But he did it. He was recorded alone because he didn't want the other actors to see him possibly screw up. So they recorded him separately. The night the show aired, I was sitting home watching it. And the minute it ended, and I'm sitting there wishing we had the ending that I'd written, phone rings and it's Dawes calling me. And he says, hey, that came out pretty good. That was amazing. I thought I sounded okay on that. Just then, he gets a call waiting beep, and he says, excuse me, I'll be right back. And I waited on hold for about 4 minutes, and he comes back. He says, oh, I'm sorry I kept you waiting. That was Messick calling to say that he thought I sounded like my old self. Don thought I sounded like my old self. Just then, he got another call waiting beep. He says, excuse me, I'll be back. He goes away. He comes back 4 minutes later. He says, that was Paul Frees. Paul's calling to tell me that I sounded like my old self. He got another call waiting beep. I said, hold on. Call me back. When the traffic stops.
Yeah.
He called me back about an hour and a half later. He had gotten calls from Hans Conried, from John Stevenson, from all his peers.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Saying, welcome back, Dawes. You sounded like yourself. And he was so happy because that was what he did. He was a voice actor, and he was a, like I said, I think the best one who ever lived.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, and if somebody wanted to argue Mel Blanc, fine. I don't have a lot of emotion invested in that argument.
You know, one of the things about that, and I'm sorry for interrupting your story, but Paul and I were just talking about this the other day. In everything Mel does, Mel is brilliant. There's no arguing mm-hmm. that. He was brilliant. Yeah. But in everything he did, you could still hear Mel. You cannot hear Dawes. You can hear his heart and soul in those characters, but he completely chameleonizes his voice, his cadence, and his acting. He processes things in his brain at different speeds with his different characters, and I've never seen it before.
Well,
He was unparalleled.
One of the reasons the early Hanna-Barbera shows were successful was because of Dawes.
Yeah.
He put the personality into the characters that they did not have in the animation.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to do, you know, people don't know, but he did on the Quick Draw Macaw cartoons, he was Quick Draw and Bobalooey. And he was on the Snooper and Blabber cartoons, he was Snooper and Blabber.
Mm-hmm.
He would talk and do these 5-part conversations with himself, and they recorded them in real time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When Mel did Tweety and Sylvester, he'd record all the Tweety lines and then come back the next day and do all the Sylvester lines. Not to take anything away from Mel Blanc, who was a fabulous actor.
Absolutely.
And a wonderful fan. But they were doing different things. Mel was not as good at Dawes at recording in real time,
mm-hmm.
and doing, you know, characters talking to himself.
Uh-huh.
And the guy, the real champ of that was Don Messick. Don Messick was the best talking to himself actor who ever lived.
Yeah, he's marvelous.
You told me once he used to overlap.
Pardon? What?
I said you told me once Don Messick used to overlap.
Don Messick would overlap himself. Yeah, there was once, I was watching a session one time, and the director stopped and said, hold it, the guy doing Fred is overlapping the guy doing Sam. And Don goes, I'm doing both those parts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
I just remember there was I think I mentioned it before, there was a letter that Chuck Jones wrote to his daughter when he had recorded the cartoon. It was like Bonanza Bunny or something like that. It was a Nasty Canasta cartoon, and he brought in Dawes to
Bowery
play.
Bugs.
No, it was the Barbary Coast Bunny.
Barbary Coast Bunny, you're right.
And mm-hmm. and Nasty Canasta, this voice was Dawes is kind of, you know, like more thuggy Mr. Jinxy type voice. But he said, Chuck wrote in the letter, Dawes started doing that, and Mel suddenly perked up and was like, oh. And suddenly he upped his game, and suddenly it kind of shook Mel up, because I guess Chuck felt he'd gotten a little complacent.
I feel like I told the story on here on one of the previous one of these podcasts about directing Mel.
I told
Mel.
That one.
Yeah, yeah.
Directing Mel, but he told me that the one time I directed Mel Blanc and something, he told me he considered Dawes his only competition ever.
Wow.
There was some pretty, Mel worked with some pretty good people. Paul Frees was not exactly.
He was no slouch.
But Dawes was the guy who had the capacity, unlike the other voice actors, to voice a star character who sounded like a star character.
Right.
I mean, you look at Mr. Jinx is probably, I mean, between that and Yogi are probably my favorite ones, but the Jinx cartoons to me are hysterical because the time he takes doing Jinx's voice, that whole, you know, bully quality pal enemy that he has with the mice is just hysterical. You know, like the way he just orders them around and everything. And that's not, and part of that, a little bit of that is he's writing what's on the script of the storyboard. But there's just such a depth to that character's voice,
that's
and Yogi
exactly,
and all of them, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about before, how Dawes actually changes the speed with which he processes stuff in his brain. And I want to put this question to both of you, because you just said a moment ago, the capacity to voice a star character's voice and make it sound like a star character. What does that mean to you as a director? What do you hear? You know, like what makes a voice stand out as a lead? How can you?
I think it's something that sets you apart. You know, Louis B. Mayer, when he was running MGM Studios, would sometimes have them take all the girls they had in their contract, all the starlets, and just do a group shot of them. He'd say, put them all together in a photo. And he'd put them all together in a photo. So now someone hands him a photo of 18 gorgeous women.
Sure.
And he would look at the photo and he'd point to one of them and go, she stands out.
Mm-hmm.
There's a star quality about her. She's got a personality. She's not generic.
Okay.
He didn't use the word generic. That's me using that
word.
Yeah. But there's lots and lots of people you see when you look at auditions. They're generic. They are perfectly competent, but they don't stand out.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing special about them.
Okay.
And Dawes would do these characters that were fully founded. They were very rounded. They worked. They weren't just funny voices. They had characterizations. And Dawes could take that character, and he could do that same voice when the character was angry, and the voice of the character was sad. And Paul Frees did a lot of star voices, and one of the things that Paul Frees used to do was he would do Boris Badenov doing the Texas accent. He would do so you've got a guy doing a Russian doing a Texan.
Yeah.
And it worked. You understood it. And there's that wonderful one of the Chuck Jones cartoons where Bugs and Daffy are disguised as each other, and Mel does Daffy doing Bugs and Bugs doing Daffy, and they're not the same voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? I mean,
yeah. I mean, I watched you direct Frank Welker doing Garfield, doing a Mockingbird, doing Garfield.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And it was like, what the hell is happening here? It was so meta.
Yes. And so it's a matter of understanding acting as opposed to doing funny voices, mm-hmm. which is the number one mistake that aspiring voice actors make. They think it's all about sounding sound. like lots of different people. And what it is actually about anything that's rounded and has... You know, it's like they're not cardboard cutout characters. They've got shape to them. You go around the backside, there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my most vivid memories of Dawes was we were in... Earl Kress and I took him to lunch one time at the old Nibbler's restaurant on Wilshire Boulevard.
Okay.
And we're standing there waiting for a table. And the hostess is about to seat the people ahead of us. She says to them, right this way. And the guy ahead of us says, exit stage left. He does a bad Snagglepuss impression.
Aww.
I look over at Dawes, who heard this, and he goes, heavens to plagiarism. I still think of Dawes. That's one of the things I think of. I just laughed for 12 minutes when he said that. He was just such a nice man.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and we don't have that kind of voice actor anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The business does not demand them, because in 1968, the SAG contract was changed. Prior to 68, if they hired you to do voices for a session, you could do as many as they wanted you to,
okay.
for the same fee. Your pay did not go up. This is why pre-1968, most cartoons, no matter how many roles, speaking roles there were done by two people.
Sure.
Almost all the early Hanna-Barbera non-primetime shows, you know, the Huckleberry Hound cartoon would be Dawes Butler and Hal Smith and nobody else. The Pixie Nixie cartoon would be Dawes Butler and Don Messick and nobody else. A Quick Draw McGraw cartoon would be
Dawes,
sometimes by himself, or sometimes Dawes and Doug Young and nobody else. And that's why there are very few women in those cartoons. And when they did have women in them, frequently Don Messick would do the woman.
Sure. Which is funny anyway.
Because they were saving money. They just needed two people.
And it's funny to cast a guy as a lady.
So there are cartoons, there's Snooper and Blabber cartoons that have 15 speaking parts in them, and they're all Dawes and Don.
Mm-hmm.
Today, if you made that cartoon, you'd have five actors for the same, you'd have to bring five actors in, each doing three,
mm-hmm.
and you know, you'd pay accordingly.
Because three is the new minimum.
Three is the minimum now. So,
or maximum.
Yes. And then you start getting to more money if you have to do more than three. Mm-hmm. So the business cultivated people who, like June Foray and Paul Frees and so on, who could do all the necessary male voices in one cartoon. The movie, Hey There, It's Yogi Bear, is like an 80-minute animated feature. Mm-hmm. The voice cast of that movie is Dawes Butler, Don Messick, Julie Bennett. Julie was Cindy Baird. Dawes, yeah. Don did The Ranger and Boo Boo. Plus Mel Blanc, J. Pat O'Malley, Hal Smith, Howie Morris, and Alan Melvin, and nobody else.
And how many characters are in that movie about?
About 50.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Howie Morris and Alan Melvin aren't even credited in it.
Oh, wow.
It's just because back then, all those guys were a cast of thousands. Today, when you cast cartoon voices in features, especially, very rarely does anyone double.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they can, nobody's saying, "Oh, let's." You know, nobody's saying, "Let's get Billy Crystal. He can do six voices." They just want Billy Crystal because he's Billy Crystal.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, you mentioned. Sorry.
Go ahead, Ezra.
I was going to say, you mentioned earlier how Mel Blanc and couldn't keep up in real time, but he had the radio background. It seems to me like Don Messick and these other people.
Yeah, but when Mel Blanc was on the Jack Benny show, he mm-hmm. played one role at a time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And what we're talking about is Dawes playing Snooper, talking to Blabber, and playing both parts.
Yeah, oh, and that's just crazy.
Part of me seems like it'd be a radio thing that they need somebody to do things like that. I guess they didn't really do that then, huh?
No. I mean, Mel played multiple roles on the Jack Benny show, but mm-hmm. he never played. Right. You know, he never had to follow himself as a different character.
Right. He was talking to someone else.
Yes, he was talking to Jack mm-hmm. Benny usually.
Mm-hmm. Okay, true.
Yeah. It's just insane to me, you know. And so now, Paul, just really quick, can I pose that question to you, going back to what I had originally asked Mark about a well-rounded voice? Did Mark say, did he cover all the bases that you would look for as well? Basically what I heard Mark say, just to recap, you know, because it's been a couple minutes here, was when you walk around the front has texture and so does the back. You know, it's not as much how you sound as knowing who you are as a character.
Well,
did I paraphrase that properly, Mark?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Well, one of the things that I really appreciate in a voice artist is somebody who's always thinking about the character. There's a thought process involved where, yes, they're coming in. This is like maybe 2 hours out of their day and they've got to go off and do another job. And a lot of times a guy will come in and do a character, even a recurring character. I get the idea that it's more, you know, to somebody like myself, and this may just be myself and a few people I know, I think we're more fans of the character as the character, that we might have a little more invested in the character's creation emotionally, rather than some of the voice artists. A lot of them love the characters and everything, but it's sort of like, which character am I doing? Oh, I'm doing the duck again. Okay, yeah, he's in here somewhere. And then they go off and they do that. And that's terrific. But there are sometimes when an actor gets invested in a character, not they go around as that character all the time, the character comes very quick to them. It's part of their thought process.
Uh-huh.
They'll start, you know, shooting lines around back and forth. Sometimes I see that in ventriloquists or puppets or puppeteers, where the puppet, you know, kind of stays alive through the process. There was a series of interviews that were on the internet yesterday from England with the Muppets, where they were, you always, you know, Kermit is being interviewed. You always, there's always a thought process on. Mm-hmm. Granted, the camera's on him all the time, and he has to be quick. And in those roles, you have to keep the character alive. You can't put the puppet down and think or take a break or anything like that, or talk as a puppeteer. But when a voice person is that invested in the character, they're always coming up with something, or they want to try something new. There was an actor I worked with recently, and I can't say who it is or the show, but he came in with a lot of enthusiasm to play this character, and he had lists of alternative, not rewrites on the lines, but let me try this, or let me try this, or I was working this out. And it made what we were hoping would be the funny character more funny, because he brought in this comedic bent and a different way of playing the character. He did it the way we wanted, and then he said, let me try a few things.
Okay.
And then he kind of set the character on his ear, so we were all laughing, and I said, that's why we hired him, because he thinks about the character like that, and he really, you know, plays that character with a lot of gusto.
Now, do you find, Mark, going back to you, do you find that an actor who is, you know, Paul, you just said that you like that collaborative spirit in a voice actor. Do you like that as well, or does it, because I know that you're often on a tight turnaround.
Well, yeah, I mean, you always, it's a case-by-case judgment call. I'll give you an extreme example where it doesn't work. For me, at least, I was casting a show. In fact, the show was Channel Umpty 3 years ago, and we had this character Ogden the Ostrich, and one of the producers wanted us to hear a certain actor. So the actor came in. We gave him the copy that I'd written, and it was lines I'd written from the script that I'd written.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts ad-libbing all over the place, changing everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't do a single line as I wrote it. So I stopped him. I said, "Hold on." First of all, you should know that I wrote this copy.
Yeah.
He I said, could you do the lines that I wrote? He says, no.
What?
And I said, may I ask why? He said, I don't do people's lines. He said, I can ad-lib better than any script you're going to give me. Nothing personal. I can ad-lib better than any script that anybody's going to give me.
Well,
so I never follow the lines.
Oh.
And I said, fine. I can't use you.
Yeah.
I said, and it's not. We had actually, it was a very interesting talk. I said, it's not that you know, I don't think you can improve material. It's that we write these lines. We've got other actors whose lines you're screwing up by not giving them their feeds.
Cues, yeah.
And he says, well, then they shouldn't be in the session if they can't keep up with me. I said, well, look, you're not going to get the part if you can't read the lines. He says, well, I don't want it if I can't change all the copy.
Wow.
I said, more power to you. You know, fine. You know, go get a job someplace else. And he left. It was actually. It may sound contentious as I'm saying here.
No, it doesn't sound contentious.
But he just.
Sounds...
This was his choice. He didn't want to do anybody else's lines. He liked what he came up with better. And he was a clever, funny guy who actually had some success as an actor in other venues, mostly on camera stuff. He just didn't want to do a cartoon when he was locked into. And the thing that struck me was, you know, this is the first time he's tackled this character. He doesn't understand this character.
Right.
He's just doing stuff that pleases him. So that's the bad extreme. The good extreme is that you have clever actors who come in, and it isn't as much as you want them changing the lines as you want them to find new ways to read them and new interpretations. And I worked for years with Howie Morris, and Howie Morris would read this stuff in ways you never could have imagined. Mm-hmm. I could predict how some of the other actors were going to read the lines. I heard them in my head as I was writing them. I could never figure out what Howie was going to do with something.
Really?
And it was wonderful. I mean, it was, when he was wrong, I could always correct him into the interpretation I wanted. But there was no way I could have directed him into the stuff he did spontaneously, because his mind just went in different directions. And he would take a line and he'd make a word that I would not have thought of. He'd make that word the most important word in the sentence. And it changed the entire attitude about the thing that way. So,
yeah, I guess well, that's I meant about this other actor. It's not that he wanted to change the lines. He brought in different nuances.
Sure.
Let me play it like, you know, it's like, instead of being so serious,
what if I did this?
Can I play it really clueless with a big smile on my face? And that take, you know, that was a very funny take. I don't think it was the one we used, but we, you know, he just came in with the idea that he wanted to play, you know, and we, you know, we had, he was the only one we were getting that day, and it's certain, and we had him for 2 hours, and it's like, have fun. You know, we're here.
Sure. Yeah. Ultimately, what you want is you want the sesh to be a cooperative venture where everybody makes a contribution and everybody feels that nobody's ego is on the line where you know, the actor isn't going to feel hurt if I tell him he's reading it wrong, or if I decide to swap the part with somebody else. And I'm not going to feel wrong if he says, I don't understand how to make this line work. I think I can improve it. Fine. If you have this, you got to get away from this I'm the boss and you're the employee thing. Mm-hmm. We're all here together to produce something together. And ideally in a session, people make suggestions and people ask questions. And then sometimes, and the wonderful thing you have sometimes is the actor will read it the way I wrote it. And he'll say, could I try one more different way? And you go, fine. You always say yes to that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we'll use that.
And sometimes
you don't. You've got it the way you wrote it. Now let me try to play with it a bit. And sometimes it's very good and you use it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes there's also technical reasons why you can't change the line.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, you know, the director usually has to know that. And there's places where, you know what happens the other times? Sometimes you have, and you've been in sessions, probably when I've done this, an actor starts improvising, he expands something, and I go, thank you, that's funny, but I'm gonna have to cut something else. This episode's running long.
Yeah.
And if you add 30 seconds there, I gotta cut 30 seconds someplace else, and I don't know where else to cut the 30 seconds.
Sure.
So you know you have to make those decisions sometimes.
Yeah, I don't know if it was one of you who told me this story, but before a session, someone had John Cleese in there. Was it you telling me this? Mm. Someone told me that in a session they had John Cleese, and he had picked up a pen. And they said, Mr. Cleese, are you ready? And he said, just a moment, I'm writing all my ad-libs. So, but anyway, that was why I asked you guys. You know, I wondered if it, and it sounds like it's completely dependent upon A, the material, B, the project, and C, the actor.
Yes.
You know, and the environment also comes to play and the appropriateness of what they're bringing to the microphone, if you will. Yeah. So that's very
fair. The other thing you should remember is, or point out to people here, is that frequently the director is not empowered to change the script.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you have so many people to answer to.
Somebody else has approved the script that they've handed it to the director and say, here, to direct this. And now if the actor starts straying from that, well, you know, the director isn't authorized to do that. Mm-hmm. At most we can do is record an alternate and say, here's another way to do it. But I can't, I have the advantage, I can change copy in most of the sessions I do. But sometimes I've done shows where I couldn't. I directed a show one time when I had to follow the script. And I was not authorized to you know, do anything more than just, you know, occasionally, you know, reverse a sentence if it was awkward. Or I couldn't actually change a joke.
Wow. Because you had so many people who had to say,
because the network had approved the script. And,
right.
And the studio had approved the script. And I wasn't the story editor. I was only the voice director. You know, you have protocols here. You have jobs. And people have approvals. And you don't want to step on somebody else's job. You don't want to... You know, if the writer wants it this way, you don't want to rewrite them necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on a show that was the opposite of all that, which was a troubled show where basically nobody had explained to the producers the producers had this idea of what the show was going to be and how it was going to be produced based on faulty information or their own supposition of how other shows worked. And they said, okay, we're going to do a show where all the dialogue is ad-libbed and we're basically going to animate from outlines. And we're going to, the show focuses on the dog of the family, which was the name of the show, Family Dog. And the dialogue of the adults and everything is just superfluous. You know, it's mostly the animation of the dog running around and the dog in different situations. So they animated a few shows like that. And I said, well, we're, and they said, these aren't turning out the way we wanted them to. And I looked over and I said, do you have scripts? And they said, we didn't really write scripts. We wrote detailed outlines. And then they went from storyboard. And we thought we'd do it Rocky and Bullwinkle style, which was, you know, the actors basically ad-libbing a lot of things to picture. And I said, one, I have Rocky and Bullwinkle scripts. They did write scripts. And I have storyboards that were written by the crew. The stuff was written. I don't know where you got the idea that it wasn't. Also, you're asking the voice actors, whoever you hire, to basically be writers. Mm-hmm. And shouldn't you be paying them for writing the story? You know, because you're asking them to come up with things on the spot that's going to carry it through. This was not the best way to start off. And they kind of said, well, we kind of know that now, but we took a chance because we thought it was like, you know, all ad-libbed. You know, we thought a lot of the best cartoon stuff is just kind of ad-libbed.
Well, the delivery sounds ad-libbed because you have excellent actors.
Yeah.
I mean, when you have an actor like Dawes who can sound like he's ad-libbing talking to his freaking self.
But yeah, he's acting.
Yeah. Yes.
And Dawes never ad-lib lines. He would come up with new ways to read things. And unusual deliveries and funny ways. But he took it as a personal challenge to take even boring copy and make it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cartoon I saw an old quick draw recently where basically it's Elka Bong meets Elka Zing and it's Snagglepuss deciding he's going to be a villain, you know, where Elka Bong is a hero. And then it's Baba Looey who comes in as Elka Pow or something like that. So all three of them are running around, you know, in Zorro type outfits. But I think they're the only characters that speak in the whole thing. And the timing is so crisp, it sounds like an ad-libbed vaudeville routine. And it's just a delight to listen to them all in a situation like that. But somebody wrote that down. Somebody scripted it on the storyboard.
If it was a quick draw McGraw, it was probably Michael Maltese.
It was, absolutely. Yeah, That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
And so, we had to, another writer and I had to go in and we had to script, you know, we had to come up with reverse scripts that actors had to come in and say. It was a frustrating way of working, you know, and a learning experience for all those involved, especially people who should have known a little bit better. But you know, the only way to get that naturalistic ad-libbed sound is to sit down and write this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're at another hour, so we need to end part two. Should we sing Oh My Darling Clementine in honor of Dawes? Or we could just play it.
Bring it.
I'm without my Clementine. We was heading for the water, 'cause the surf was breaking fine. We was snuggled on my Honda. Shucks, I was fond of Clementine.
Oh my darling, oh my darling, oh my darling Clementine. She is lost and gone forever.
I'm without my Clementine. We was waiting for the green light at this busy traffic sign, when a Woody pulled beside us and this guy saw a Clementine.
Oh my darling, oh my darling, oh my darling Clementine.
Such a weakness for the Woodies had my darling Clementine. 'Twas the next light where she left me, like a flash my Clementine shoved my surfboard in the Woody, and they left me far behind.
Oh my darling,
I
sure miss her when the surf is breaking fine. But I really miss my surfboard more than I miss Clementine.